From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's been bloody news day after day from Iraq. Insurgents struck again today in three cities, killing at least 71 people and bringing the death toll to nearly 400 since a new Iraqi government was unveiled just 2 weeks ago. About 30 people were killed and 60 wounded in a single suicide bombing today in Tikrit, hometown of Saddam Hussein. The governor of western Anbar province was kidnapped Monday as U.S. forces mounted a major offensive in the area along the Syrian border. On the political front, one of four Sunni Arabs selected to join Iraq's new Shiite majority cabinet rejected the job, embarrassing a Shiite prime minister who hoped to appease Sunni fury over their diminished clout. And a committee has been named to draft a permanent Iraqi constitution, a good sign, but one that also foreshadows what may be the fiercest struggles yet over the country's future. On the streets of Baghdad and elsewhere, disillusionment is real, and violence appears unchecked. Here at home, the war's price tag has now gone well past $200 billion. In this hour, we'll talk with NPR's Philip Reeves, just out of Iraq, about what he has seen and heard. And later this hour, we'll hear from The New Yorker's George Packer. He writes in the magazine's current issue that Iraqis who risked their lives voting have steadily lost faith in the leaders they elected. Tonight on Point, in the tumult of conflict, the state of Iraq. Joining me now from his home in New Delhi is NPR's correspondent Philip Reeves. Reeves is a veteran of the BBC and the London-based newspaper The Independent. He's covered stories from the Mike Tyson trial and siege at Waco to elections in the former Soviet republics and the conflict in Chechnya, elections in Afghanistan, and the hunt for Osama bin Laden. Since early last year, he served as India-based correspondent for NPR. He just spent a month in Iraq, in Mosul and Baghdad, his seventh reporting tour through Iraq since the fall of Saddam Hussein. Philip Reeves, thank you for joining us this evening.
You're welcome.
Philip, we were struck in your last interview before you left Iraq this time, just a few days ago. You said in the morning news that on every one of your previous visits to Iraq, the half dozen previous visits to Iraq, the situation had looked worse. That this time, when you arrived a month and some ago, things looked better, and then before you left, they looked worse again. Describe that train of perceptions for us.
Yeah, I was very struck by it myself. I got there about 5 weeks ago, I suppose, and Iraqi colleagues were, for the first time for 2 years or so, saying to me that actually things were getting better. Now, remembering, you know, we see a very narrow horizon working in Iraq at the moment as journalists, because we're not free to work as and roam as freely as we would like. But nonetheless, they were saying that, and there was a mood of optimism and a sense that things might be changing. That changed dramatically during the month that I was there, and it was really a rapid downward slide, I suppose. I mean, one saw this corroding in front of one's eyes, that hope. I've always thought that the Iraqis in Baghdad, at any rate, have had a remarkable capacity for optimism, given the circumstances in which they live. And I think those views expressed to me by Iraqi colleagues were a reflection of that. But it fell apart. It fell apart because of a surge in violence. But above all, it fell apart because of a sense of disillusionment in the business of creating a government in the aftermath of the elections that were so widely portrayed as a success. There was a feeling that, you know, 3 months after the elections, there should be some form of government in place. And while I was there, there were clear difficulties in creating that government.
Now, that's interesting. It's the insurgent attacks of the last 2 weeks that have so captured headlines here, and they look terribly bloody. We've seen these horrible pictures again and again of suicide bombings, body parts everywhere. The sense that there's no safe place outside the green zone anyway, or appears to be sometimes in much of Baghdad. Do you really think that it's the political problems that have Iraqis more concerned than the daily security threats to life and limb?
No, I'm not sure that's what I'm saying either. I mean, they clearly are very concerned about the security situation. They have been since the fall of the Saddam government. I'm sure you recall it was followed not only by eventually this insurgency, but also immediately afterwards by an enormous wave of crime and looting, which very much upset and disorientated them, and that concern about security is very central. But of course, it feeds into the political question. the reason that they feel, I sense there, at any rate, a sense of disappointment amongst Iraqis, especially Sunnis, about the failure of the political process to produce a government 3 months after they elected a parliament. The reason that that is, one of the reasons that that is of concern to them, is because they want a authority in place that is going to deal with this security nightmare that they're living through.
Philip, speak to us, if you would. We'll look at the politics in more depth, but talk to us first about this insurgency. It's front and center, again, in the last couple of weeks. What's driving it? What's the goal? It would appear that it's set on this government, this whole project, not succeeding. So who's fighting it? What's driving it? What's the goal?
It's impossible to be specific about any single goal. It hasn't yet evolved a clear political face, although it's possible that it eventually will, and it is clearly made up of a number of component parts. There are in the mixed Sunni Baathists who resent the fact that the country has now, or the power in the country has now, swung towards the Shia majority. But also there are clearly Islamists, fundamentalists, for want of a better word, some former regime elements, as the military like to call them, and I suspect quite a large number of people who've joined in this insurgency because of the events that preceded or came along with the arrival of the US military and its allies. For example, the amount of life lost. I mean, I suspect there's an element of revenge involved. So it's an insurgency with a number of component parts, but we do know that there's a very large, and probably the predominant part, is Sunni driven. I think its goals, as far as we can define them, is to be as disruptive as possible, to make sure that this transitional government that's been installed with, you know, a very large role in that being played by the U.S. Government and by the administration in Washington, that is disrupted, and so what they do appears to have a certain sort of strategic purpose in terms of its timing. It was quite interesting to see how, when the political process was faltering, the violence suddenly soared upwards.
The capacity to produce that violence is impressive, to say the least. We've seen well over 100 strikes a day on coalition forces in Iraq, even 150 and more sometimes. Where are the resources coming from, and what about the manpower? The U.S. military is now, the Marines are engaged in a big offensive out on the Syrian border in western Iraq, western Anbar province there. How much of this insurgent strength is coming in from outside the country?
Well, it depends who you talk to. One of the things that's really worth noting about this insurgency is that it actually doesn't have a problem the problems that normally confront insurgents. It has weapons and access to weapons. Iraq was a massive weapons dump. It has a fair degree of elementary military training. Saddam made sure that many Iraqis received that. Most people can fire a Kalashnikov, and many can use rocket-propelled grenades, and it appears many that, you know, there seems to be no shortage of people who are able to build and plant these IEDs, improvised explosive devices, booby trap bombs, and so on. So they have already sort of overcome the kind of problems that often face insurgencies, in the sense that they have weapons, they have recruits, and they have an environment in which they seem able to operate in reasonably freely. As to where they're coming from, I mean, I think, and remember, one is always working with sort of blinkers on in this environment because of the conditions in which journalists work, but I think that it's still primarily driven by Sunnis, although the US military say, and I think they're saying this honestly, that there has been recently a increased trickle of people in from outside via Syria, and that an element of those are Saudis, particularly into the northern city of Mosul. They also point out, just while we're on the subject, that there appears to be no shortage of people who are willing to kill themselves at the wheel of a car as suicide bombers in the name of the, you know, the cause that they perceive themselves to be pursuing.
We've clearly seen that. We hear reports of neighboring countries also hoping that this whole American democracy effort, Iraqi democracy effort, fails. Clearly, there's concern about Syria with all those troops out there, the biggest fight since Fallujah going on right now. We've also heard reports about Saudis coming across the border into Iraq. Is the democracy project wished ill by its major neighbors there in Iraq?
I'm not sure that I could quote chapter and verse which would be helpful in, you know, discussing that issue, except obviously to note that if this political process is pursued along the path that it is now going, it's obvious that Iraq will be a Shiite dominated country, and that will make it the first Shiite Arab country on the map, and it is surrounded by Sunni Arabs, and so one imagines that they are less than enthusiastic about that prospect. But having said that, I have to say that, you know, as you mentioned earlier, I've been there seven times, and I haven't seen anything concrete that shows that there is meddling on a national level by neighbors of Iraq, although the Iranians occasionally get blamed for interfering by various US sources and so on. So I would not want to point the finger, but clearly in the Middle East, suspicions about these matters are constantly there, and indeed were always there prior to this particular conflict.
And riding high right now, Philip Reeves in New Delhi, NPR correspondent, just back from his seventh trip to Iraq since the fall of Saddam Hussein. We're glad to have you with us tonight. There's a lot more we want to learn. We're looking at the state of conflict in Iraq. It's confusing. We're trying to sort it out. Philip Reeves is with us. You can join the conversation, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the state of conflict in Iraq. We'll be joined in a few minutes by George Packer of the New Yorker magazine. We're joined right now from New Delhi, his home, by Philip Reeves, NPR correspondent, who's just returned from his seventh reporting tour through Iraq since the fall of Saddam Hussein. President Bush says he's encouraged by the way things are going in Iraq, that good progress is being made, and yet we see the bloody reports coming out every day. And it's hard to know exactly what to think. Philip is helping us sort through all this tonight. Philip, I wish you'd look with us for a moment at the political side here. A cabinet has finally been put together, a very arduous process to get to that solution. It's got Sunni members. You were there during the period where Iraq was struggling to put that government together. Why was it so hard? And what do you make of the cabinet they finally come out with? Is this one that can be effective going forward?
I can answer the first question. I'm not sure whether I'll be able to answer the second. Why it was so hard, if you strip it down, it was so hard because there was this desire to try to get representation within the government of the Sunni minority, most of whom did not vote in the January elections. At the same time, there were many concerns about which Sunnis should be those representatives in this transitional government, particularly among the Shia, who felt that some of the candidates that the Sunnis were putting up had too many links for their liking to the previous regime of Saddam Hussein. That's the fundamentals. Overlaying all of that, there were 1,000 sort of power games going on over the defense ministry, who should that be, over the oil ministry, another key ministry, who should occupy that post. But if you strip it down, I think probably the sort of central theme was who should represent the Sunnis and how much representation should they get. And the question now, I suppose, which plays into the second half of yours, is whether the Sunni minority, approximately 20% of the country, will feel that those who are now in government actually do represent them, and whether that feeling will draw them away from the political process or pull them into the political process, and what effect that will have on the insurgency, which, as we mentioned earlier, has a large Sunni component.
The Sunni minority ran the show for decades in Iraq. The Shiite now, as you say, have seemed very determined to have the Ba'athist out, at least out of the security apparatus. On the other hand, it was the Iraqi army was largely run by Sunnis before. So one wonders if that Ba'athist, cleansing of Ba'athists can possibly coexist with Sunni satisfaction with the government lineup.
And it's not only the Sunnis. The US is also keen that effective leaders are now found to sort of stand up and take responsibility. We often hear them saying that. And there is an acceptance amongst the US within the military and also within the State Department that there will be among those leaders some Ba'athists who happen to have considerable local influence and sometimes also tribal influence, which is very important in Iraq. And they don't want to see them ruled out of occupying those positions, because for them the central concern now is to establish some degree of calm and also to create a local leadership that can mesh with a locally created security force that can establish some degree of normality in this, at the moment, pretty chaotic country.
Of course, the fear sitting behind all this is that either before or after a U.S. withdrawal, Iraq could descend into civil war, fighting between Sunni, Shia, and Kurds. What about the Shia and Kurds? They both did very well in the elections. They've both got a big piece of the governing pie. How are they getting on?
There are some tensions there, which were demonstrated the other day when the Kurds insisted on the rewording of one of the ceremonies involved in installing the transitional government to place more emphasis on the autonomy of Kurdistan. So there are clearly some tensions there, and indeed there were concerns amongst the Kurds over some of the Shiite potential candidates for jobs, particularly, for example, the Interior Ministry. And their concerns were concentrated on the fear that the Kurds feel that religious Shiite Muslims will wield undue influence in Iraq, the Kurds being Sunnis but primarily secular, and they are rather suspicious of the religious Shia. And so that has been a factor in that relationship, as far as one can detect, as I say, from the rather remote position of being a correspondent in Baghdad during this particular period. I say that just because, you know, getting access to reliable information and getting the big picture is not easy at the moment.
Philip, maybe you should fill out that picture. There's more I want to ask, but we should understand exactly what you and other correspondents are up against when it comes to knowing what's even going on. We heard recently, maybe this is just apocryphal, but we heard that people are now charging $30,000 for a cab ride from the Green Zone to the Baghdad airport. Is that urban legend, or are things outside the Green Zone just that dangerous now?
They are pretty dangerous outside the Green Zone, but I must say I have never encountered a correspondent in Baghdad in recent months who would contemplate taking a cab ride anywhere for any amount of money. They have their own cars, their own drivers.
I shouldn't say cab ride. I guess it's the convoy that would get you from downtown to the airport. But I mean, I don't mean to dwell on it, but is that absurd? Or are people really spending thousands of dollars to hire the gunmen and armed convoy to get them in and out of the country?
I've heard the same story that you relate, and have never been in a sort of position to be able to verify it, but it wouldn't surprise me. The road to the airport is extremely dangerous. It's bombed all the time, and it's interesting to reflect, I suppose, that we're now more than 2 years since the fall of Baghdad, for want of a better word, and since the Saddam statue was toppled, and the road to the airport, you know, the city's key strategic road in many respects, at the heart of the capital, is still absolutely out of the control of both the government and the US-led forces in Baghdad. So that is a good indication, if you want a sort of simple sign of the degree of problems that have been faced there. That makes a good example, I think.
Well, let me ask you then, in that kind of insecure, radically insecure environment, how do the other people who bring us news out of Iraq go about their work?
It very much depends on the level of danger at any given time. When I first got there at the beginning of April, we were moving around Baghdad and able to go and visit people, as long as you knew who you're going to see and where that person was. That changed as the level of violence picked up and the general atmosphere became more and more dangerous, and one went out less and less, to the point where one never went out at all. We were dependent, therefore, on a small team of amazingly courageous Iraqi staff who would go out and gather information for us, with whom we've been working for a while and who have essentially been, you know, somewhat trained as reporters now. And one is always wildly impressed by that, and to the extent that, you know, in a landscape where there so often seems to be so little hope, that little group of people who help out the Western media is one area where one does feel a little hopeful because of their amazing courage and also their just positive attitude about the world.
So does that mean when you're sending them out that you're holed up where? In the green zone?
Well, I never discuss exactly where NPR is at any given time in Baghdad. Journalists do go in and out of the green zone because, of course, that is where the Iraqi government, the parliament, actually meets. But I can say, I suppose, that we do not base ourselves in the green zone. It would not be a particularly good place to be to gather a good picture of what is going on in Iraq because it would only give you one side of the story, which of course is the side of the story provided by the US-led forces there and of course the transitional Iraqi government. And we feel we need a larger picture than that, not least from the streets of Iraq and particularly Baghdad, which is where we glean, frankly, most of our information.
But you do go into the green zone. Presumably when you're there, you're in contact with US military for briefings and other interaction. Do you have a sense of the mood among the American military in Iraq of how they think this project is going?
I'm actually very interested in the mood amongst the US military at the moment and spent a week with them embedded, both on this last trip and the one before, because I think it's a very good way, although I have, frankly, you know, had reservations in the past about being embedded with any military. I think, you know, there are risks, of course, of it becoming rather one-sided journalism as a result of being, you know, with one side and fed information more or less exclusively from one side. But if you do these days embed with the military, you get quite a good insight into the way the military is interacting with the Iraqis on the ground. And you also see how varied the views that the individual soldiers take of the conflict that they're involved in. And that can range from those who firmly believe that they are fighting evil and on a mission to destroy more or less the same horrendous people who committed the crimes in New York on 9/11, and others who see, you know, Iraq as something of a different prospect and are quite eager to try to understand the complexities of Iraq's tribal system, its ethnic differences, its religious differences, and to try to kind of genuinely kind of lock with all the complexities of that society. I think in exploring that relationship between the US military and Iraqis, you learn a lot about, you know, this conflict and whether it may or may not resolve itself anytime soon.
And on the other side of that equation, the Iraqis you spoke with, you said they were optimistic when you arrived for the first time for this, your seventh visit. By the time you left, they were not again. When Iraqis are taking a gloomier view of the future, what do they see? What do they fear, Philip?
Well, their ultimate fear is that the country will fall apart. Of course, this would not be the fear of some. It would be the hope. But those who are just trying to live ordinary lives and get back to some degree of normality and, you know, have their kids go to school and university and the rest of it, their fear is that there will be civil war in Iraq, that the transitional government will fall apart, that the security services that are being set up at the moment will eventually desert their posts, I suppose, as they did to some degree in November, and that will then fracture into all sorts of militias that will have a sort of sectarian character, and that you will go into a Sunni area and it'll be protected by a Sunni militia. You travel a mile down the road, you go into a Shiite area and it'll have a Shiite militia, perhaps the Mehdi army of Muqtada al-Sadr. That is their fear. Although I'm not suggesting that that is my prognosis necessarily, it's not an unreasonable fear to have either.
Philip Reeves, you've given us a great tour of the boardwalk there. We appreciate your time tonight. Thanks for joining us from New Delhi. Wonderful to have you.
It's been a pleasure.
Philip Reeves is NPR's India-based correspondent. He just spent a month in Iraq, his seventh reporting tour there since the fall of Saddam Hussein. You can join our conversation tonight. We're looking at the state of Iraq. What do you make of the news out of Iraq? Join us, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is George Packer, staff writer for The New Yorker, who has covered the Iraq War and its aftermath from its earliest days. He's the recipient of two Overseas Press Club Awards for his work in 2003, one for his coverage of Iraq. In his most recent column for The New Yorker's Talk of the Town, Packer says the American architects of the invasion of Iraq can no longer control its outcome. George Packer, thanks for being with us tonight.
It's a pleasure.
So in the last 2 weeks, we see a government formed and all kinds of bombings and death on balance. What do you see, progress or retreat?
I'm I'm concerned by both of those developments. The formation of the government is in some ways a very good thing, simply because they were able to come to an agreement. And one could say that the fact that for the first time in Iraq's history, the Shiite majority is represented in its numbers in government, and there's a Kurdish president of Iraq. These are historic and remarkable developments, and they've sort of followed inevitably from the course of events since the invasion in 2003. But once you nod toward the sort of historic nature of this new government, I think one can only be disquieted by the level of Sunni antagonism toward it, toward its formation, the amount of infighting that's gone on, both among the Shia, between the Shia and the Kurds, and especially between the Shia and the Sunnis over the personnel and the formation of the cabinet. And then, of course, the fact that over the last 2 weeks, 400 Iraqis have been killed in these dreadful suicide bombings, and no respite in sight, is just as a kind of a picture of day-to-day living. It's nightmarish in Iraq, and the fact that it's become numbingly familiar doesn't make it any less so.
You're writing, we'll look forward here, but you're writing, looking back a bit, that two dominant American views of the war going in were both wrong. What do you say? What do you mean?
Well, in a way, both the pro and anti-war views before the war gave far too much credit to American omnipotence. The pro-war view was that we can create a democracy in the heart of the Arab world, which will quickly spread to the region, and in the end will solve the problem of tyranny and terrorism emerging from that part of the world. The anti-war view had it that the architects of the war were interested in seizing Iraqi oil, or in dividing the country, or in imposing their own people in power, and none of that has happened. Iraq has had its own say, and partly, I think, due to the incompetence of the post-war period, and partly just due to the fact that this is an incredibly complicated, difficult-to-govern country, always has been. No one should have been under any illusions that America, with all of its power, could impose its will on Iraq.
And you're saying now it's clear that it cannot, that it will not, that it's in the hands of Iraqis. President Bush, in his most recent press conference, it seems that he's fundamentally saying, look, we're not going to stop leaning into this. We'll be at Iraqi's back. We'll be helping them. And there's something inexorable. Once you get a vote, once you get a government with American support, that we will head toward a good solution here. Is there something inexorable about that?
Of course not. I mean, there's nothing inevitable about democracy. It has to be made by human beings. And it's maybe the hardest system of government to create. And Iraq has proved to be, I would say, fairly inauspicious soil for it. It's not impossible, and I think America does still have a key role to play. The presence of our troops is pretty much all that's keeping Iraq right now from the kind of total dissolution that Philip Reeves said was Iraqi's greatest fear. And we do have some leverage with our money and with our huge diplomatic presence, as well as with our 145,000 troops. But in the end, it really is about the Iraqis, and I suppose it's been about them from the beginning, but it's taken us a while to realize that.
You're writing also that in Washington, there are some who would like to once again say mission accomplished, as unresolved as it might be, sort of declare victory and begin to, if not depart Iraq, at least push it out of the headlines, out of view.
I think that is what's happening. In fact, I'm quite confident that in private, a number of war boosters, both in and out of the administration, are saying that we have essentially achieved our goals, that we have an elected government, and that whether there's a connection or not, things in Lebanon, Egypt, even Syria seem to be moving slowly in a democratic direction, or at least the logjam is being broken. And so I think that no one is saying mission accomplished in public. It was too costly for the president. But I think privately, those with an extremely long view of history that doesn't take into account daily car bombings and dozens of people being killed do see this as a success. And And do also, I think, want it no longer to be the center of American foreign policy. Some people have moved on to Iran. North Korea is beginning to take up a lot of airtime again. I worry that Iraq is going to be forgotten by Americans except those who have loved ones serving over there.
Well, we're looking straight at it tonight. George Packer, please stand by in New York. We're talking tonight about the state of conflict in Iraq. You can join the conversation. Is progress outpacing disintegration? And what stage is this conflict at now? Is the president's optimism justified? Do you share it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking tonight about the state of conflict in Iraq. You can join the conversation. What do you think? If the United States just hangs in there, will this eventually go its way? And what indicators are you following in Iraq? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joined tonight by The New Yorker's George Packer. He most recently covered the elections in Iraq. He's been covering the story from the very beginning. He's just completed a book out in October entitled The Assassin's Gate. He describes there the intellectual history of the individuals in the U.S. and abroad who conceived and planned the war. We're delighted to have him with us tonight. Let's take calls. Listeners have been patiently waiting. Miriam's calling from Newton, Massachusetts. Hi, Miriam. You're on the air.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. And this program, it comes right in time. I've been troubled all day, and in fact, I was going to call On Point to ask you if you would do a program on the questions we're going to ask, and they're brief. I've just written three little headlines, and I would be very grateful for some comments on these.
Let's hear it.
I heard a transcript of Seymour Hersh last night talking at University of Illinois Urbana, and mm-hmm. then an interview that Amy Goodman of Democracy Now! Did with him. And of all the things he said, which were disturbing, the three that really stood out for me were, first, that he said, if you look at this, he said the Sunni governments, all those governments around there except for Iran, never wanted this government, they don't want it. He said, has it ever occurred to anybody that not one of them offered congratulations on the formation of the Iraqi government?
Including big Saudi Arabia right next door.
Right.
Point two, Miriam.
And by the way, apropos of big Saudi Arabia,
yes.
And please don't cut me off, I've got just two more quick things to say.
Mm-hmm.
I was really, this is connected with, the picture that we saw of Bush
holding hands with the Saudi.
I was really shocked when he said that a very close source of his told him that King Abdullah said that he was stunned when he came to Washington, and President Bush asked him as a favor to pardon Ahmed Chalabi. I mean, that's not relevant to your program today, but I was stunned because it seems to play into.
Miriam, I want to ask you to give us your points quickly, please.
Okay, the other two points. One, that we've now set up what we went to Iraq and made war to destroy, and that is this Mukhabarat, a kind of rogue army, and he said that the Americans begged to have Alawi stay so that he could head it to fight the insurgents.
Rough new intelligence. Alawi was a tough guy. And point three?
And the point three, his conclusion was that civil war is not only imminent, it's begun.
It's begun. Miriam, thanks very much. George Packer, first to the regional picture. It is interesting. We have not seen delegations flying in here from other nations. Iran perhaps accepted, though that's a tricky relationship. But what about, let's just start with Saudi Arabia. Do they want the American effort, the Iraqi democratic effort, to succeed? They're right next door, lots of money, lots of people.
Well, I think the caller and my colleague, Cy Hersh, mm-hmm. are both on target with this. The Sunni Arab neighbors have been at best detached and at worst somewhat counterproductively involved in Iraq in the last 2 years. Right before the elections, King Abdullah of Jordan said that a million Iranians were going to cross the border to vote, and there was a sort of specter of the rising Shiite tide, which tapped into some atavistic Sunni fear of being engulfed by the Shia coming from the east.
Sure, and this is supposed to be their turf. It's been a century's battle, so
it is an old Sunni Arab feeling that they are the rulers of the Arab countries of the Middle East. In Iraq and in in Lebanon, there are large Shiite populations that were always sort of an implicit challenge to that notion. It really goes back to the Ottoman period when the Ottomans used the local Sunni Arabs as proxies, especially in Iraq, to in the military class and in the bureaucracy. They ran the country while the Shia were, you know, more the economic backbone. And it's just an amazing turning of history upside down, and it's hard for the Sunni Arab neighbors to look on it with equanimity.
And perhaps they don't want to accept it, perhaps even actively. Right now we've got on the Syrian border a different political profile, but we've got the largest U.S. military operation since Fallujah there, a big one, lots of at least 14 U.S. casualties,
yep.
Many insurgent casualties. They say they're trying to close down material and people coming in from Syria, maybe looking for Zakawi there as well. That would suggest that they do feel like they've got problems on the borders.
Well, Syria is a different case. I wouldn't conflate it with Saudi Arabia
right.
and Jordan. I don't think those governments, I've seen no evidence that they are actively colluding with the insurgency. There's plenty of evidence that the Syrians are turning a blind eye toward the crossing of jihadis of their border into western and northern Iraq. And you're absolutely right. There's at least 1,000 Marines, a really large combat force, engaged in what I read is quite heavy fighting with very determined, entrenched insurgents who are quite prepared to fight to the death.
What about the state of Iraqi security forces? The U.S. seems to be hinging an awful lot, maybe everything at some level, on the rise of a domestic security force that can take over in large part from U.S. forces. Miriam says that, again, your colleague Sahir says it's being turned into a sort of carbon copy of the rough, tough, nasty Saddam version. I don't know. I look at it, and what I've seen is a lot of retreat and ineffectiveness.
Well, I think we have to talk about two different kinds or profiles of recruit. One is someone from the old defunct Mukhabarat or another of Saddam's many overlapping security services who has been brought in a sense, to fight fire with fire as the person best equipped, you know, with the best knowledge to know how to defeat the Ba'athist-led insurgency. Alawi began doing that. It looks like the new government is going to start undoing it, and I think Iraq is going to go back and forth on this question of the role of former Ba'athists for quite some time. But there's the other type of recruit who's a young Shiite who needs a job and who is really cannon fodder, and they're the ones who were dying in the dozens and scores in these terrible car bombings. But I wanted to say one other thing,
yes.
a bigger point about politics in Iraq, and that is Iraq does not have great leadership. When you look at some of the post-totalitarian societies of the last 20 years, Mandela in South Africa, Havel in Czechoslovakia, Bawenza in Poland, and other places, they all had a unifying figure who is capable of reconciling former enemies and of sort of rising above the divisions that created problems in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
Iraq does not have that person. The closest one is Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, but he's a Shiite cleric, and so there's a limit to how much he can unify the country. The exiles simply don't have the credibility inside Iraq to do it, and no one has emerged from inside Iraq.
Is it too much to ask, George Packer, for one kind of godlike figure to emerge out of such a deeply divided country on sectarian lines?
Well, I think the real problem is not sectarian division, because other countries have produced
mm-hmm.
leaders to overcome sectarian division. The problem is Saddam destroyed his own society. There was absolutely no room for such a person to develop, to live, to breathe in Iraq. The only real political experts were outside the country or in Kurdistan, and a Kurd simply can't be the unifying figure in Iraq, and the exiles, partly by their own behavior and partly by the sort of ingrained suspicions of Iraqis on the inside, have not emerged as the ones to do it either.
And what about the kind of naming and framing of this conflict? Again, President Bush trying to put it in the most positive terms, saying we're there for the long term, it's going to work. Others saying, you know what, there's a risk of civil war. In fact, it may already be in civil war.
Well, I think the Bush administration has had a strategy all along, which is, and it's its strategy on every issue, which is essentially to ignore bad news, to stay relentlessly on message, and to assume that both sort of political forces and reality will follow, that the best strategy for victory is to say we are winning. And that has been the case in Iraq. They, in private, they have made some shifts, some called some audibles, but certainly publicly they've yielded nothing. And I would say it's that very attitude that has led to so many of the problems in Iraq, because inevitably it becomes a form of groupthink where bad news cannot penetrate and key decisions can't be made when they need to be. You asked earlier about the formation of security forces. We're 2 years late in training Iraqi security forces in a serious way. The early efforts were completely inadequate, and only now are we beginning to do it in a way that stands a chance of defeating the insurgency. But that means the insurgency has had a great chance to recover from being off balance immediately after the invasion, and it really is controlling the tempo of events at the moment.
Catherine's calling from Greensboro, North Carolina. Hi, Catherine, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I have a question and a criticism, I guess. Lately, I've only been hearing coverage in the media, and especially from NPR, because that's where I get most of my news.
Mm-hmm.
But the coverage is all about the political and military strife taking place in Iraq today, about the insurgency, about Shia versus Sunni, or about Kurdistan's autonomy.
I mean, you've got to admit, when hundreds of people are getting blown up, it gets your attention.
Oh, yeah, definitely. But my point is that back when Baghdad first fell, Dick Gordon went and did a program, and program from Baghdad, and really addressed the basic well-being of the everyday Iraqi citizen in Baghdad. Talked about whether or not they had the basic means to live, electricity, clean water, adequate food, and safety. And I feel like none of these are being addressed in the media today.
So what about the real life on the block, in the neighborhood, how people are living? We'll try and pick it up, Catherine. Thanks for your call. George Packer, you were there most recently in February.
Yep.
What do you say to that?
Well, that's a very good point, and I think it's a direct result of what you and Philip Reeves talked about earlier, which is the difficulty of reporting. It really, in April of 2003, reporters were able to go into most neighborhoods and spend as much time as they needed to. Now their trips are targeted and extremely brief. I was in Basra in January and early February, and Basra is a little bit easier to work in, and I spent a lot of time moving around the city and went into some people's houses. And on the sort of the quality of life front, things were not very good. A lot of people said you turn on the tap, and a lot of the time there's no water. Electricity is 2 hours on, 4 hours off, which really creates hardships, especially with summer approaching in as insufferably hot a city as Basra. It's a very poor place. It's been pulverized by the years of Saddam and sanctions. There is some reconstruction going on. There's been a lot of money poured into it, but those reconstruction efforts just seem to keep spinning their wheels because of both sabotage and just the general problems in the security environment, and also perhaps excessive expectation on the part of both Americans and Iraqis that a country as dilapidated as Iraq could be rehabilitated almost overnight. So,
and this is in the far south, famously far from the sort of heart of the conflict. With all that, George, what was your sense about the state of mind of the Iraqis? I mean, a large part of this depends on them hanging in with some kind of hope for a better future, you know?
I would say that's almost all of it. I would say that's where the real action is, inside their minds. And there I cannot express my admiration for their tenacity and toughness and courage, really. They have been brutalized for many, many years, and they continue to be brutalized and to be disappointed, perhaps partly because what choice do they have? It's hard to give up on your own life.
Yeah, absolutely.
But they're not giving up, and some of them, individuals, are showing just tremendous courage in trying to seize the opportunity, because there is still an opportunity to become owners of their own government and their own country. But most Iraqis are frightened and are exhausted and consumed with simply getting by on a day-to-day basis. And you tell them, well, you now have a democracy and a wonderful chance, and they say, well, it's not much good to me at the moment, because I can't walk outside without being afraid of getting killed.
And to Catherine's point, if all we're hearing about is the insurgent attacks and politics because reporters are not secure enough, because the streets are not secure enough for people to go out and talk to Iraqis there. That is a kind of comment in itself on their daily life. Let me get another call here, if I could. George William is calling from Carrboro, North Carolina. Hi, William. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had an observation and then a question. The observation is on how difficult it is to name what's going on in Iraq.
Yeah.
Is it a conflict? Is it a war? Is it an occupation? And Seymour Hersh said last night, you know, we're still at war, and we need to acknowledge that. We declared victory, but in fact, the war isn't over. And so I suppose I'd be interested to hear your expert's opinion about whether or not we're still at war, and will we not admit it for legal reasons? Are there obligations that follow if we declare that we're still at war, that sort of thing?
We've got it, William. Thanks for your call. George Packer, I have to admit, I find myself floating all over the place, sometimes just talking about the invasion, sometimes saying war, conflict, even project, which gets very vague. In a way, it's just semantics, but in another sense, as William suggests, it's not. How would you characterize what's going on here?
Well, I've always felt that Iraq is more complicated than most Americans can stand, and Iraqis, of course, have to stand it every day. I've always felt it was a kind of liberation. It gave them an enormous opportunity to exercise rights that they never could dream of before. At the same time, it is an occupation. There's a heavy foreign presence on their soil. A lot of basic decisions are still made by foreigners. There's a lot of incidents involving Iraqis and foreigners that are bloody. You could say it is a civil war, but if so, it's really only being fought by one side at the moment. It's a civil war, and only the Sunnis are showing up. It's an insurgency, which means it's going to last for years and years. These things don't end quickly, and I think the president has not prepared the American people, never did, for how long and difficult this is going to be. It requires enormous patience on our part as well as the Iraqis. And at times it seems that the Iraqis have more patience than we do, and also a little bit more of an ability to live with the cognitive dissonance of it, because it is, just as you say, a fantastically complex picture, one that I certainly couldn't reduce to one single rubric.
We just got a minute left, but George, you say that 2 years ago there was a moment when the Americans might have molded Iraq after their own desire, for better or for worse. Say that moment has passed. So what is the American role, the best the United States can do, if it is, as you see it, largely now in the hands of Iraqis?
I think that behind the scenes, some of our capable diplomats are going to be leaning on the new Shiite-dominated government not to push toward too hardline an Islamic constitution, and they'll be leaning on the Kurds to stay in the game and to continue to play the role of essentially being the secular liberals in Iraq, because that is their, in a sense, by default, the role they're in now. And we'll be not leaning on the Sunnis, because I don't think we really have any leverage with them, but we'll be trying to draw the Sunnis back into the political game. And that's the hardest thing of all to do. But we can do that with money and with behind-the-scenes influence, but really it is up to the Iraqis.
And that's the agenda for now. George Packer with The New Yorker, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
A pleasure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.